First Coast Connect with Melissa Ross is sponsored in part by Baptist Health.
Some of Florida's major players get serious about moving away from fossil fuels, but are they moving fast enough? Good Tuesday morning. We're live from Studio 5. I'm Melissa Ross, and this is First Coast Connect. Thanks for listening on this, the summer solstice, the longest day of the year. Just ahead, how a major utility in Florida says it plans to get to zero carbon emissions. 549-2937 to join us about that. Then later, support grows in the city for a millage hike for schools so teachers can get a raise. All of that and more ahead this morning. But first this hour, with gas prices inching towards $5 a gallon, the urgency to get this country off fossil fuels grows stronger each day. Now this week in Jacksonville, JTA will be holding a zero emissions forum that you can take part in. At the same time, the parent company of Florida Power and Light says it has set a goal of zero carbon emissions by the year 2045. The utility giant says it'll get to zero through an expansion of solar and nuclear power. Bruce Ritchie covers environmental and energy issues for Politico here in Florida, and he's here now with more. Hi, Bruce.
Good morning, Melissa.
Good to have you. So, folks, give us a call. Are you frustrated with $5 a gallon gas? The solution is obvious. Energy independence, getting off fossil fuels. How do we get there? Give us a call. 549-2937. Join us. Emails to firstcoastconnect@wjct.org. Tweets to @MelissaInJax. Facebook always open too. So Bruce, you've been reporting on this story. The parent company of Florida Power and Light has set a goal, an ambitious goal, of zero carbon emissions by the year 2045. They want to expand solar power and also use nuclear power to get off fossil fuels. Tell us more about this move by this major utility player and what it means for the energy mix in Florida.
Well, quite a few utilities around the country, including TECO, Tampa Electric Company, and Duke Energy in Florida, have set what they're calling net zero goals for carbon emissions. And it has raised some questions about why FP&L, Florida Power and Light, the largest utility with 5.7 million customers, had not set a goal. And then last, the chairman and CEO last year, Jim Robo, said that these net zero goals were kind of an illusion. They weren't quite honest. And yet FP&L said they were working towards it. And then this past week, they came out with what they called a real zero goal. They say it's like night and day compared to net zero, and that they're setting a goal in which they won't do things that the other utilities are doing, like planting trees and doing things to offset their carbon emissions. And said NextEra and FP&L, its subsidiary, said that they're going to actually eliminate all carbon emissions from their plants, mostly by a huge increase in solar. They're going to go from having about 4,000 megawatts of solar today, and they're already building solar very fast and in all kinds of places around the state, to having 90,000 megawatts. So basically, I believe that's about a 20 times increase by 2045.
Wow.
So,
yeah, go ahead.
So it's a big increase in solar. They're also going to step up their use of battery storage, so that they'll have this solar energy to use at nighttime. They would go from having 500 megawatts a day to 50,000 megawatts. That's a 100 times increase. And they would use some of that battery power to produce what's called green hydrogen. They would convert many of their natural gas units to run on this green hydrogen produced by solar rather than using it produced from fossil fuel sources.
Now, Bruce, as we talk about Florida Power and Light, I want to make mention of a story in Jacksonville. JTA, the Jacksonville Transportation Authority, this week is hosting its inaugural Power Up Zero Emissions Forum. And they're doing this in partnership with our local utility, JEA, and the North Florida Clean Fuels Coalition. This is happening today at the Prime Osborne Convention Center and tomorrow. Their keynote speaker is the head of the FTA, the Federal Transit Administration, where they talk about how to get to zero emissions. We'll go to your calls in a moment at 549-2937. So this sounds like an ambitious goal, and certainly the world's leading climate scientists overwhelmingly say we must simply decarbonize this planet to have any hope of mitigating the worst impacts of climate change. Bruce Ritchie, can Florida Power and Light's parent company realistically achieve these goals? Can they get there?
I don't think they'd be proposing if they didn't think they could get there, but it's going to require a lot of effort to create this green hydrogen technology and deploy it everywhere. It's going to take a massive effort to buy land, to buy solar panels, to put the solar panels on land, on roofs, on parking lots, wherever you can find it. And because right now they're building these 75 megawatt plants and covering 500 or 600 acres of them. You can see them if you drive down I-10 west of Jacksonville. And so they're going to be doing a lot of work to convert the current system over to this green system with green hydrogen, lots of solar. But some of the advocates are saying they need to go further. They need to do more to keep people from using a high power rate, using a lot of electricity to save on their bills, to make their homes more efficient.
In a moment, we'll talk about some other issues involving Florida Power and Light with Bruce Ritchie of Politico. But first, what are your thoughts about this utility giant trying to get to zero carbon emissions by the year 2045? If we can more aggressively move toward renewable energy, if we could all get our hands on an electric vehicle, we wouldn't have to pay $5 a gallon gas. And that's just one way we'd all benefit from this transition. Let's go to your thoughts. Join us. It's 549-2937. James in Jacksonville. Hi, James. Good morning.
Hi, good morning, everybody. I just wanted a quick mention that it's frustrating to me as a driver to pay the gas prices that we're paying at the pump, but I seem to be more frustrated with my colleagues or friends that, you know, drive these gas-guzzling vehicles and just refuse to understand how international oil markets work and the fact that there's not one person that's in charge of the price of oil. There's not just this immediate fix-all that somebody can intervene and make gas $2 a gallon again. This is just international commodities markets. And the ironic thing to me is that these are typically people who vote red, who don't want federal government intervention in anything. And then all of a sudden they get affected at the pump and immediately they want the federal government to intervene in capital markets. It makes categorically no sense. The principles go out the window as soon as gas goes up in price. And, you know, my concern is that, yes, if everyone drove more fuel-efficient vehicles, gas would be in a better state. And the fact is, you know, this is an economic issue, and people have to make economic decisions based on that. Maybe you don't buy a truck that gets in the teens, you know, miles per gallon the next time you go to the car lot. And, you know, we'll all remember this and paint this into our decision. Thank you for your time.
Yeah, thank you, James. You know, Bruce Ritchie, everybody's upset about gas prices, and certainly politics comes into play. There's been talk at the White House of suspending the gas tax. That would bring the price down, I think, maybe 20 cents a gallon, not a huge impact. The sad reality is that this administration, like all administrations, is limited, as the caller said, in controlling the price of gas. There are other things we could be doing in this country to more aggressively move toward renewables. What are your thoughts, since this is what you cover full-time, environment and energy issues?
To say politics comes into play is just so generous.
It's an understatement, yeah.
It is political season full on, and it's just I share the interest of your caller. There are two disconnects, conversations and explanations for what's going on. There's the energy analysts who will point to the war in Ukraine. They will point to a world fuel market, constrained supplies, issues with production that began before COVID and were worse after COVID. And then there's the political argument of the Biden administration has been hard on oil. This is something DeSantis has promoted even while he opposes fracking and is opposed to offshore drilling. He also is blaming the DeSantis administration for having a war on American energy. Buckle your seatbelts. It's going to be a bumpy ride till November.
Benjamin in St. Augustine. Hi, Benjamin.
Hi, Melissa. Thanks for taking my call. This is a really exciting topic that you have today.
Thanks. Yeah, I'm interested in it too. So what do you think?
So I think we've reached an age in our civilization where the power company is irrelevant because they're going out there putting hundreds of acres of power cells covering up our land, and they're going to charge us for electricity, which we could all get power cells on top of our own homes, and then that way the power grid never collapses after a hurricane anymore. We all have our own power system. We don't need these power lines running everywhere. I'm sure there's a place for them, for industrial power and, you know, keeping things going, but our civilization has evolved beyond. And we're also trying to save ourselves from a climate crisis. And the sad truth is, Melissa, we're being told that it's all about carbon in the air and we're producing too much carbon. But the reality is, if we get our carbon under control 100%, all of these problems that we've created are really based upon habitat destruction because we've destroyed our plant's ability to filter itself. So we're still going to be having all these problems even if we get carbon under control. We need to cut carbon not only for climate change, but because it's a carcinogen and it causes all kinds of health problems. So we need to stop burning it, but there's so many better and bigger solutions than just relying on FPNL to continue to overcharge us because we want to save on gas, but it's just going to shift to electricity. We don't need some monopoly controlling us anymore. We all need power on our own roofs.
Thanks, Benjamin. You know, I'm so glad you brought that up. Bruce Ritchie, Politico, getting solar power at your home or business should be a lot easier in Florida than it is. I speak from personal experience. At our home, we are in the process of trying to install solar panels. It's a bureaucratic morass. Let me just say to get through this. Florida Power and Light is a major player, investor-owned utilities in Florida. They want to preserve their monopoly. They don't want to make it easier for individual homes and businesses to become independent of needing a utility's power. Can you talk about your reporting on that?
Well, yes, this was one of the hottest topics during the recent legislative session back in this late winter and spring. There was a bill to cut the payments that are now made or required to their customers for rooftop solar. Basically, they sell you a kilowatt of power, you sell it back to them at the same price, and they didn't like that. The utilities say that the cost of the grid needs to be maintained by everyone, not just by people who don't have solar on their homes. That was a furious argument, pitting the solar industry against the utilities. And Governor DeSantis ended up vetoing the bill, and he did it for basically consumer reasons, because there was a part in there supported by Duke Energy, supposedly, that would allow utilities to go out and recover that gap cost until the prices could be reduced, the prices that they paid. So that could have added a line item to the bills. But, you know, whether we can all just get off the grid one day and produce the power on our own roof and be self-sufficient, I think that's everyone. I think that's a lot of guys' fantasy.
That's our dream, yeah, exactly.
but then the other one is that, you know, the minute We need power. We want the lights to come on, and we want a reliable system that supplies in between. So that's a struggle I think we'll be having for a long time, and a debate we'll be having for a long time. But the prices have gone down on solar panels for your rooftop. They've gone down. They're more efficient than they used to be. I'm not quite there yet. I'm in the saving energy and having shade on my house.
So. By the way, speaking of the governor, he did just announce a $4 million state grant to build a water supply plant north of Jacksonville in Nassau County. It would serve a giant industrial park. Guess what? That park is owned by Florida Power and Light. 549-2937. In a minute, we'll talk about another story you're covering related to FPL, Bruce. But first, let me get to some tweets. You have reported that NextEra, the parent company of Florida Power and Light, is going to do this massive expansion of solar. But nuclear power will also be part of the mix. Getting lots of tweets about that. Here's one from a listener. He says, small modular reactors, long touted as the future of nuclear energy, will actually generate more radioactive waste than conventional nuclear power plants. This according to research from Stanford University. Nuclear power is always controversial. How will this be part of the energy mix? Can you talk about your research there?
They're not changing the nuclear that they have now. So nuclear is considered non-carbon. Lots of folks have problems with it. FPNL has proposed and received a license to build two new nuclear units at its Turkey Point power plant. They've got two in St. Lucie, and they've got two nuclear units together south of Miami at Turkey Point, and they have a license to build two more. But they're telling me those two additional units are not part of the plan. And they're not planning on moving forward with them anytime soon, part of it because of the fiasco with the nuclear plant in Georgia that has gone up in price immensely and taken longer to build. And I think
you're talking about the Vogtle power plant in Georgia.
Correct.
Yeah, the cost of new units at Vogtle more than doubled to $30 billion plus, I think.
Mm-hmm. Right. So FPNL says that's just on the shelf for the foreseeable future. So their plan would continue to have nuclear in the future as part of their Real Zero plan, and that's a trademark name for their plan to eliminate carbon emissions. It would still have nuclear, but it would not add nuclear.
It's 549-2937 as we speak with environmental and energy reporter Bruce Ritchie of Politico. JTA is holding a zero emissions summit in the city this week. Florida Power and Light's parent company says they're going to get to zero carbon emissions by 2045. Here's an email from a listener. The Biden administration opposes new oil leases. They oppose the construction of pipelines, fracking, but at the same time, they approved foreign pipelines, begged foreign oil producers to increase production, and opened oil wells in much less environmentally regulated areas than we do here. All right. So before we move on and talk about some of your other Florida Power and Light reporting, Bruce, what about that question and those points from that listener?
I guess he might be talking about the Keystone Pipeline that was going to take oil that goes from Canada, take it to the Gulf of Mexico. That's a argument I haven't covered a lot recently, but I'm not sure that would factor into the current price of gasoline or any refinery capacity. There's a lot that you can point to and say that we could do in this country to increase our production of gasoline. That, of course, increases your burning of gasoline, which increases your carbon emissions. Electric cars, some people will say is the wave of the future and what we should be looking at. Other people think, I've seen a lot of conspiracy theories out there that this is all being done to promote electric cars. So it's election season.
Yeah, I mean, if electric cars were more readily available and more affordable, I think many, many Americans would immediately switch. It's just getting access. At the same time, I mentioned the Power Up Forum JTA is holding in partnership with JEA and other players. They're trying to talk about converting their transit fleets to zero emission to meet federal, state, and local sustainability and climate goals. Public transportation is a piece of this too, Bruce, yes?
Oh, I definitely think so. I've lived in places with much better mass transit, and I've lived in places with worse. And it gets kind of forgotten, you know, between the argument about price at the pump and your environmental friends telling you to plug in your car, that there are a lot of us who can't afford cars or don't need the second, third, fourth car, you know, that kids need to be able to get around, older people need to be able to get around. It would be nice to see some more discussion about transit-friendly cities and neighborhoods where you can walk and bicycle and get around with electric buses and having things closer to where you live and work. And that kind of gets lost mm-hmm. in the discussion. And it's good to hear that Jacksonville is having a forum to maybe talk about these issues.
Yeah, that's kicks off today at the Prime Osborne Convention Center. Now, at the same time, Florida Power and Light, you report, wants to spend billions of dollars to base its future power plant supply issues on the need to avoid a winter storm in Miami. This winter storm planning issue is also something that is making headlines with Florida Power and Light. Tell us about that.
Well, at the same time, a lot of environmental groups are cheering on FP NextEra for coming out with this net zero emissions plan. They're looking at a 10-year plan that they've introduced to the PSC recently, which says we want to change the way we plan for our future power needs. And instead of saying how many power plants do we need to provide for your summer air conditioning, we need to change it to how many power plants do we need to prevent a mass power outage like the one they had in Texas a couple of years ago. And so therefore, they're basing their future power scenario on the need to avoid a winter storm in Miami with below freezing temperatures. And it's not sure clear what the cost is. Some of the critics say it could cost billions. The FPNL says it could cost just a dollar a month for the average customer. But you know, there's 5.7 million customers. So, mm-hmm. And a lot of the same groups that are praising their zero emissions plan are saying this is crazy to base it on this. And it's all about building more plants and spending more money, spending ratepayers' money to build out a grid that on the basis of the least consequential concern of a winter storm.
Mm.
So that's sort of a fight going on now. You've got two diverging arguments over how the future of the grid should be.
Well, with all of this said, and with gas prices being what they are, and with consumers growing in frustration over this situation, you know, what do you think remains the biggest hurdle for this country to really get serious about decarbonizing? And are these players like Florida Power and Light, shouldn't they have done this already? Are they, how behind the curve are we here in Florida on this matter?
You know, I mean, the biggest challenge sometimes just seems to be cost. When gas price goes down, you know, the Hummers get driven, and people are buying their big car and saying things are great. You know, leave us alone, and prices go up, and then suddenly everyone is running around talking about solar panels and drilling and pointing fingers and it's about technology and it's about research and it's about evolution and moving towards a future that is sustainable for not only for our pocketbooks today, but also for future generations that are going to be here long after us. And we need to be thinking longer term.
Bruce Ritchie, he covers environment and energy issues for Politico. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you.
Well, much more still ahead later. One influential local group is lobbying for a property tax hike for Duval Schools. We'll check in on that. But up next.
When you want to take a day off, you can have your parents write in a note saying that you were sick. But if your parent writes a note saying that you just needed a day for yourself mentally, they won't take that. It will be unexcused. And we're trying to change that.
Student activism on the rise in Florida. We'll tell you how next. Well, mental health issues and suicides are at epidemic levels for teenagers. Some kids are getting more involved as activists in Florida. One independent high school club, the Bridge Connection, is lobbying the Florida legislature to recognize that kids need mental health days as an excused absence, the same way they can call in sick with a physical illness. For more on this, I spoke with students Caitlin Stern and Maria Perez. They're both 16 and going into their junior year at Pedro Menendez High School. Here's that conversation. Hey, girls. Good to talk to you. Thanks for coming in on your summer break to be with us.
Thank you for having us.
Good to have you. So let's talk about the effort that you're doing through your club, The Bridge Connection. This involves getting the legislature to treat mental health issues the same as physical illness. Caitlin, let's start with you. What's the goal?
So when you want to take a day off, like even for any reason, you can have your parents write in a note saying that you were sick, whether you were sick or not, and they'll make an excuse. But if your parent writes a note saying that you just needed a day for yourself mentally, they won't take that. It will be unexcused. And we're trying to change that.
Now, I guess a bill to this effect died in committee. Maria, kids of your generation have had enormous mental health challenges. The pandemic, worrying about school shootings and other things. What's it like to be a high schooler today? And, you know, why do you think this is something that lawmakers should consider?
So, I mean, something you have mentioned is the pandemic and actually most currently the school shootings. I feel like those two factors are like really implemented in teen mental health. When it came to the pandemic, a lot of students did not know how to cope with themselves, did not know how to be healthy, how to, you know, improve on their mental health, on their physical health, you know. And coming back to school was just like a hit, a pow, a thing that they were like, I know I did it a few years ago, but it was like 1 to 2 years that they were separated from it. So, you know, getting back together, getting back started, getting that like routine going was hard for them. And now with the shootings that we're receiving, with the safety that hasn't been really implemented throughout the school system, it's been something that I bet a lot of students have in their minds. Like, am I going to be able to go home today and be safe? Am I going to be able to get out of this class without seeing others and being scared from others? So it's a little complicated and it's a little hard for them. But slowly, little by little, that's what we're here for. We're trying to make that a better place, make that somewhere where they can be comfortable.
Tell us, Caitlin, what the Bridge Connection has been doing to try to raise awareness about teen mental health challenges and what you'd like the state to do.
We emailed multiple people about wanting to like meet again to introduce it.
Introduce a bill.
Yes.
That would give, allow kids to take a mental health day at school.
Yes, because mm-hmm. like Maria was saying, like with all that stress, you won't be able to like focus on like your schoolwork. And because of that, obviously your grades will plummet. But if you take simply one day or maybe 2 days to just to yourself so you can think and not stress about everything else, because it's not just going to go away, just so then you can focus more on mm-hmm. like I said, schoolwork and stuff.
What else makes it hard to be a high schooler today? When you talk to your peers at Pedro Menendez High, you know, what's driving depression and anxiety for kids? Because they are at epidemic levels right now in this country.
There's a lot of stress put on kids, really any age, from their parents, from teachers, and so on, like really anyone around them, on who they are like allowed to be and if it's okay for them. Like they don't have to fit into a certain like stereotype, but that's what it feels like for our age.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, anyone really.
What I would also say that, like you said, like family, friends, I would say friends and also teachers, like the educational system, they have this set stereotype of, you know, perfect student, perfect straight A's, no absences, no nothing. Just hitting that social norm, just fitting in has of with your family, with your friends. Now with your school, you have to be that one person that has to be perfect on certain things too. They can't really identify themselves. Like there are other things like identification of either sexuality, religion, political things. Everything just aligns and mm-hmm. it keeps adding up in one single individual who's not even grown up enough to know what they're going to have for breakfast in the morning, you know? So it's kind of like those things that just keep building up and causing more things to add up.
So your club, the Bridge Connection, which is an independent club, is trying to do what it can. You have another project that you're working on too, Teens Talk to Teens. Tell us about that.
Obviously, like Mr. Miller has said,
that's your advisor. Yeah.
Nobody knows like the mind of teens than like other teens do. So if we were to go and speak to, like adults, they're not going to know how we feel. Like, nobody's going to know exactly how you feel, but it's going to, like, they can relate better when they're more closer to our age. So, yeah.
How can people find out more about your efforts and support you?
We're working on advertisement, like, with social media and stuff like that, so we can get our club more known.
It's called the Bridge Connection. And enjoying summer break so far, but ready to get back into this as soon as you get back to class?
Yes.
Yes.
Well, I want to thank you both so much for being with us. Caitlin Stern and Maria Perez, both rising juniors at Pedro Menendez High School, and their club is the Bridge Connection. Thank you both, and best of luck with the rest of your academic career in high school and beyond.
Thank you.
Well, if you live in Duval County, you need to mark this date on your calendar, August 23rd. It's primary election day. And among the issues you'll be asked to vote on is whether the Duval County schools can levy an ad valorem operating millage hike of 1 mil. Basically, it's a small property tax hike to help the school system in particular to give teachers a raise. The Jacksonville City Council is a nonpartisan group of local business leaders, and they have come out in support of the millage hike for Duval Schools. Civic Council President and CEO Jeannie Miller is on the line with more. Jeannie, good morning.
Good morning, Melissa.
It's good to have you. So what prompted the Civic Council to weigh in on this millage rate issue?
The Civic Council has been studying education as part of its strategic objectives and strategic plan since 2016, and really some time before that. But looking at ways to enhance the overall education system in Duval County, we know from research that when people relocate to our region and they work in Duval County and they live in another county, the number one reason they live in another county is education, followed by public safety. So education is very important to the long-term economic investment and also business attraction and also growth for our county and our region.
Sure. Now, in Duval, the statistics aren't great in terms of teacher pay. We're ranked 58th mm-hmm. out of 69 counties in Florida for the average teacher experience, 40th out of 69 counties for teacher salaries. Mm-hmm. Vacancies are off the charts. The Duval right. County Public Schools needs to staff classrooms, and they need to keep veteran teachers on side. So that's really, isn't that the primary driver behind this?
Yes, it's a primary driver. And it should be noted that over the last 6 years, instructional vacancies, so teacher vacancies, have increased over 155%. But within the last year, since the start of the pandemic, instructional vacancies, teacher vacancies have increased by 98%. So what you're experiencing is, low unemployment rate, rising wages, and a great demand for diverse talent in the marketplace. And teachers, I mean, the Wall Street Journal has recently stated, teachers offer a wide variety of skills and for private companies. And as you said, the other part of this is not just recruiting teachers, but retaining teachers, because we know that the effectiveness of a teacher is directly correlated with the effectiveness of the student. And the longer that person is a teacher, the more effective they are.
Now, 20 other Florida counties have successfully implemented similar ballot referendums to improve their schools. Duval County, of course, we've already passed a half-cent sales tax to improve physical plants, improve the school buildings, which are among the oldest right. in the state. This millage rate would help with teacher salaries, athletics, and art programs in the schools. And can you explain, Jeannie, for a homeowner of, say, a $300,000 home, how much would their property tax go up per year if this is approved?
Right. So for a $300,000 home, I don't know if I have that exact number, but it will be, I think, maybe $100 a year. I'm looking for that number, but I think but I have that number. I think it's important to understand that the capital tax, because a lot of people maybe confuse that, the capital tax, the 5 cent tax that was passed, or the half penny tax, pardon me, think about that as for external structures, for the physical structure that someone goes to school in. So that is for the building and the surrounding grounds. The millage rate, so none of that, those funds can be used for inside the classroom. The millage rate increase, this is for 4 years only. It can be sunsetted or renewed after 4 years. And it is for inside the classroom and programs like athletic programs or art programs and some enhancements to physical education or maybe, for certain types of equipment. But it really, really is going to be focused on inside the classroom and a good portion of it on teachers, but also on programs.
And if you go to the website duvalschools.org/vote, there's a lot more information about this. And I found the answer to that question. If you have a home, on the website it says if you have a home with a value of $300,000 and have the $25,000 homestead exemption, you will pay $275 more per year. That's about $20 more per month. If you're a renter, you don't pay property taxes directly, but it could result in a slight rent increase. Well, we've already been seeing a lot of that anyway. DuvalSchools.org/vote for more about this. We're speaking with Jeannie Miller, president and CEO of the Jacksonville Civic Council. CEOs and business leaders now saying they are in support of the millage rate increase for Duval County Public Schools. The primary is August 23rd. You need to go to the polls that day. You'll be asked to vote up or down on this issue, along with some other contests on the primary ballot. Now, if I may, Jeannie, I want to ask you about another hot-button issue. The Civic Council has already issued its thoughts about a process for community reconciliation around the issue of Confederate monuments, and you expect that process to begin later this summer. The Jesse Ball DuPont Fund is going to be working with the City Council and also with a team out of the University of Virginia on this matter. The Civic Council supports that process too, correct?
Yes. And it's important to note that the Civic Council has been studying issues related to the barriers and obstacles for non-white citizens in our community since 2020 and even somewhat before, but really looking at what can the business community do. And in this case, looking at a understanding similar to the HRO, this is a very controversial issue. It's a difficult issue. Our community is at great odds with each other. And in order to move forward, this community needs to come to some type of resolution. And so the language that we have, the Civic Council has used, is about community reconciliation. The process is the result of months of study by a group, one of our subgroups that have been looking at this. Mari Kuraishi with the Jesse Ball DuPont Fund, in fact, has been one of the lead researchers on this, and she visited other communities. But the process we came across was a kind of a mediation or facilitation process advocated initially by the International Bar Association, but that process was adopted based on what other communities around the world have experienced. So most communities in the world, cities and even countries around the world, have experienced something like this. And, you know, what comes to mind would be Germany, but there are many, many others where there has been some internal struggle to decide how to look at, how to explain a history. And so based on principles learned from those experiences and this International Bar Association combined with a United States Commission on Historic Spaces came up with a set of guidelines and principles. It just so happens that the University of Virginia has an institute that is dedicated to, and they're really the only ones who have experience applying this model. So if we think of a way to mediate or facilitate a productive community conversation, and I wanted to just dispel, there's some misnomers out there and maybe misinformation.
Yeah, there are. And I'm so sorry to cut you off, but we are out of time. So okay. I hope you'll come back and we can have a deeper conversation on it later this year. But thank you so much, Jeannie Miller, President and CEO of the Jacksonville Civic Council. Thanks for your time.
Thank you, Melissa.
When we come back, today is the longest day of the year. How UNF is marking a special campaign around that after this.
When you make a career switch, but it doesn't really work out the way you expected.
I'd maybe get 4 or 5 hours of sleep at the most, but sometimes I would just wake up in a sweat thinking that I missed a phone call or something.
I'm Kimberly Adams. Is it worth it? That's next time on Marketplace.
tonight at 6 here on WJCT News 89.9.
The U.S. may be looking at its final days with abortion protections under Roe v. Wade, and one man has played a pivotal role in shaping that reality.
If this is what you've dedicated yourself to for 30 or 40 years, imagine what this moment feels like to you.
How Leonard Leo helped catapult conservatives onto the nation's highest court this afternoon on All Things Considered from NPR News.
Tomorrow, starting at 4 on WJCT News 89.9.
On the next Fresh Air, how lonely, exhausting, and bankrupting parenting can be, yet nannies, daycare workers, and preschool teachers are typically underpaid. We'll talk with Angela Garbus, who says it shouldn't have to be that way. Her new book is called Essential Labor, Mothering as Social Change. Join us.
Today at noon on WJCT News 89.9.
For decades, Congress has been deadlocked over how to curb gun violence. Is that about to change?
I think we want to show to the American people that we can actually legislate on the areas of mental health and gun safety.
New mental health provisions are central to a framework that some senators hope will become law. Next time on 1A, what kinds of provisions are they? And is the help going where it's really needed?
Today, starting at 10 on WJCT News 89.9.
Here we go. Welcome back. Well, a new exhibit opens today on the UNF campus. It's part of the Alzheimer's Association's campaign called The Longest Day. Now, Alzheimer's Association chose today, June 21st, the summer solstice, the longest day of light in the year, to invite people from around the world to fight the darkness of Alzheimer's through raising awareness. We're pleased to welcome Jessica Boreski, UNF's Art Gallery's Director. Good morning.
Good morning. Thank you.
Good to have you. And Dr. Jody Nicholson, she's the UNF PACT Study Director, and that stands for Preventing Alzheimer's Cognitive Training. Hey, Dr. Nicholson.
Good morning.
Well, in a moment, we'll hear about the exhibit. But first, Dr. Nicholson, let's begin with you. How did UNF get involved in this Alzheimer's research project?
So Preventing Alzheimer's with Cognitive Training is a study that came out of the University of South Florida, and it's funded by the National Institute of Aging. We are recruiting 7,600 participants across 5 sites. So UNF was chosen as one of 5 sites with USF, UF, Clemson, and Duke. Here at UNF, we are tasked with getting 1,300 participants. And what we're asking participants to is come in. We're asking for people over 65, and we will train them how to do some computerized cognitive training programs, and we would like to follow them for 3 years.
So in a minute, we'll let people know how they can learn more about that. At the same time, it is the summer solstice, June 21st, the longest day of the year, the longest day of light. And this longest day campaign is brought to light so beautifully on the UNF campus. Jessica Boreski, you direct art galleries at UNF. Tell us about this new exhibit. It's called Forms of Knowing, Cultural Documents Considering Alzheimer's Research.
Yeah, and I also just want to note that this exhibition was co-curated by my colleague in art history design, Jenny Hager. And this exhibition is a two-part exhibition. The first will be opening today, closing on November 10th, 2022, which we will have a closing reception. And the second part will open and close during the same time frame. The first, which features artists Rosemary Oakman and Ellie Brown, will be showcasing multimedia artworks as well as iron pieces. So it's a little bit of 2D and 3D. Both artists work with folks from the Alzheimer's community. Ellie Brown specifically worked with her father during his process with Alzheimer's. And Rosemary works with different communities, aging communities. We are hopeful to have the artists here for the fall to do programming within the community and at UNF. The second exhibition portion will again open on the longest day in 2023 with artists Keisha Lucas and Lori Ferdette, and that will also close fall of 2023. This exhibition, and I just want to say that the UNF galleries, we have 3 spaces. the Lufrano Intercultural Gallery, of which this exhibition is taking place at the UNF Student Union, the UNF Gallery of Art, which is also located on our campus, and then, of course, the UNF Gallery of Art at MoCA Jacksonville.
Three places to see this.
And this exhibition will be at the Lufrano Intercultural Gallery. Yes.
And a reception today opening that.
Yes.
Okay, that's great. Now, let's go back to you, Dr. Nicholson. How can people get involved in the study that you're conducting?
So they can go to pactstudy.org. That's P-A-C-T, study.org. Or they can call us at 620-GAME, 620-4263. And we will get in touch with them to walk them through the process.
Pactstudy.org. And the symbolism of talking about this on the summer solstice, that's a powerful way to literally and figuratively shed some light on this disease. Yes?
Yeah, and we're really excited. So our opening reception is this afternoon, and we will actually have folks from the Alzheimer's Association with the Longest Day tabling at the reception. PACT will also be at the reception this afternoon, so folks can actually come view the artwork and also sign up for PACT at that time as well. And we will continue to have a kind of interactive component of the exhibition throughout the time that it's up for folks to reflect on the artwork, to kind of speak back to the artwork, and to also get involved with PACT too.
Again, pactstudy.org, and a reception today on the UNF campus unveiling Forms of Knowing, Cultural Documents Considering Alzheimer's Research. It's part of the Alzheimer Association's campaign called The Longest Day, shedding light and fighting the darkness of Alzheimer's on this, the summer solstice, the longest day of light in the calendar year. Thank you so much, Jessica Borusky, UNF Art Gallery's director, Dr. Jody Nicholson, UNF PACT Study Director. Thanks for coming into the studio today to talk about this with us.
Thank you so much for having us.
And that's our show. Thanks for listening. Thanks to Senior Producer Heather Schatz, Associate Producer Catherine Hobbs, and production help from Trinity Websit Bass. Our director today is Josh Torres, with technical help from Miriam Ganas. I'm Melissa Ross. Here's a little sunny music for you on this, the summer solstice. Enjoy. And we'll be right back here again at 9 a.m. tomorrow. Make it a great day.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.